And the general government will come to order. And we'll continue our informational hearings today. Subject this time, the Public Employees Retirement System. And I want to thank the members for coming back after lunch, those who have. Let's see, any reminders here? To the committee, just a reminder that Kara is going to be on vacation the 24th through the 5th of June. So if you care to get any information, well, you're not going to be able to. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Okay. Let's begin here and let's call forward Jim Voitko, Director of PERS. And Jim, if you want to bring on some cohorts, you're certainly welcome.
I do indeed, Mr. Chairman. I'd like David Bailey, our Deputy Director, to join me.
Thank you. Before you begin, if I can just talk to the committee for a moment about what's been going on. This would be our third meeting of the interim, as I recall, where we have entertained subjects from PERS. As we began some months back, we were watching the progress with PERS as relating to some of the issues that were contained in House Bill 722, and I believe 722, the number from the last session. And we've been watching the PERS board over time enact some of those points of 722. And so what we've been doing is just really riding herd on the process, working with those who are concerned with this to try to ferret out what they feel the difficulties are in the PERS system. And as most of you know, Mr. Voitko came to this job probably a couple of months ago now?
Just 2 months ago.
A couple of months. And so he's a relatively new director. I've had a very, I think, very gratifying time talking to him, trying to get his opinion on the situation as it exists. And so I appreciate the all the work that he has put into keeping in touch with me and us on this issue. We want to talk about a couple of different subjects here today. You'll see on the agenda, report on the employer outreach program, something that maybe some of you don't know of, a report on the white paper flowcharts. Not long back, we determined as a result of a meeting that a flowchart would help illustrate the money flow in the PERS system. And you'll see an example here, and that will be explained to us shortly. Local governments have had concerns and issues, as you well know, with the PERS system, and we'll have a guest today addressing that. And perhaps if the PERS Coalition wishes to speak today, they can do that if they choose. So with that said, Mr. Voitko, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be invited to speak to you today on several of the many activities ongoing at PERS. In our last presentation, we talked a little bit about pooling and bonding, among other things. You know, I'm supposed to say to you how much I appreciate coming here, but my comments are not mere pleasantries. We actually spend our work days wrestling with the many challenges, including just a few today that I'll talk about, that involve our retirement savings and health insurance programs that we're responsible for. There are many critical initiatives that we have launched and that are underway. Yet I have to confess, even though it's our agency, that because many of them are structural in nature, like our work process initiatives, or they're very long-term in nature, like our multi-year reengineering project, or worse yet, they're financially arcane, as is true of much of our actuarial work, we don't often have the chance to talk about our work, so actually we're happy to be here. And that's precisely what we're going to do today, talk about several topics based on our understanding of your continuing interest in PERS. Three in particular. First, we'd like to update you on a project we discussed at our last meeting, the creation of a flowchart indicating some of the key pathways within the PERS system through which employer funds and member benefits flow. Secondly, I'm asking David Bailey, our deputy director, to provide the committee with an update on our special employer outreach project, which he personally is about to launch within a few days. And finally, I'd like to conclude with a few remarks about our work to codify the very large body of rules and administrative practices that's underway and why that initiative is so important. So let me begin with what, for lack of a better term, we're calling the flowchart exercise. Several stakeholders, as the chairman mentioned, as well as the PERS staff, felt that a graphical representation of the flows of funds into and through the PERS system would help our numerous discussions with employers, labor unions, retiree organizations, and other groups that would make them more productive. As the committee is probably aware, PERS holds frequent meetings with stakeholders on a wide variety of topics. Sometimes these are formal meetings or semi-formal meetings, which we call ad hoc advisory meetings. They're typically designed to deal with topics that are subject to rulemaking or to be brought to the board of directors. Others are less formal, and we bring people together to share views on a variety of topics that aren't ripe for rulemaking yet, but we want to nonetheless get people's views. For an example, here in this very building, Mr. Bailey has had one that was specifically intended to help us design the lengthy presentation which we will give to employers around the state, which you'll get a slight preview of today. We have begun work on the flowchart as promised. It's proving to be a challenging exercise, and I take that as confirmation that it will have some value. While we must suspend work on it from time to time to complete pending rulemakings, conduct the long-awaited multi-week series of employer meetings, and of course produce our biennial system plan financial evaluation, we believe it should be done by mid-September. And our objective in the exercise is not to actually duplicate the massive, and I truly mean massive, financial calculation systems in place at PERS. That would cost millions if it were feasible at all. Instead, our goals for this project are twofold. First, we want to show the most important pathways through which funds flow within the system. There are many pathways, but sometimes only a few members that have some unique characteristics, their dollars actually flow through them. So we're trying to get if you think of it in terms of a railroad, we're trying to get the trunk lines in place and displayed to our stakeholders. Secondly, in selected instances where there are critical calculations or other funds flow decisions are made, we're going to try to direct the user to the key governing statutory provision or administrative rule so that they can match it to a written rule that says how we do these things. A third objective, which I hadn't really thought of until this moment, is that this is something that we can make available to outside auditors so that when they come in and look at how we operate the agency, they can compare it to how we say it ought to work. I brought a draft exhibit, which is to my right, which illustrates how we're pursuing these two objectives. I have to tell you that Picasso's estate need not be concerned about any competition from our work. And I apologize for the small fonts, but you can see that just a slice of the funds flow patterns that have to do only with one aspect of the agency, and that is the distribution of earnings, which is an important one, and it's why we started on this one, gets pretty complicated in very, very short order. Nonetheless, we're going to continue to plug away at this, and I expect that at some point, if you're interested, I can bring a dozen or more panels in, and we can line them up and connect the dots, and we can enjoy ourselves. But I did want to bring this as an example to show you what we have in mind. As you can see, if you get the opportunity, in a variety of different places, nodes, if you will, you'll see references to administrative rules that are in place and codified to help the user. We can answer questions about this project now if you like, Mr. Chairman, but if you prefer, we can proceed on to the other two topics and then answer questions on all three topics at the end.
Let me ask if anybody here does have a question about the flowchart. Okay, for right now, let's go ahead.
All right, well then let me ask Deputy Director Bailey to give you an update on our employer outreach program.
Thank you, Jim. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to update you just on the status of the project, and then I have I've cut this number of the slides out of the presentation just to try and touch on the key points with you, and you've received a handout, and I'd like to go through some of those with you. As far as the status of the project, we're about to start that next Monday. We'll go to Northeast Oregon for 3 days and hold group meetings in Pendleton and then in Ontario. During June and then going into July, we'll try and reach every corner of the state. We're going to Southern Oregon June 5 through 7. Later, we'll go to South Coast, North Coast, Bend Redmond area, John Day, Albany, Eugene, Roseburg, Dallas, Salem, and Portland. And, of course, our attempt is to touch every region of the state. If need warrants, we'll go back again and schedule other meetings if that appears to be appropriate. We've sent invitations to all the employers in the areas that we've scheduled so far, and we've pointed out, and those have gone to the, what you might call the CEO or the chief financial officers, but we've made it clear that elected officials are also invited to these meetings. We also have information on our PERS website that's available, and you've got a copy of what that is in that handout. Later, we're hoping to attend some of the conferences that will be held this summer, the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, and some of those, if they're willing to have us. We'd be very happy to do similar presentations at those meetings. We're also doing some individual employer meetings as we go out. For those employers that really have a significant need, we want to meet with them and talk a little bit more detail about their situation. We've also sent out a letter to each employer, and it's informing them of their account status versus the accounts of their employees. As I mentioned before, and all, it's a key point in our presentation, that the relationship of the employer's account to the value of the sum total of their members' accounts is a very significant issue today and very important. And we've sent out a letter in, talking about that, and then including for them those amounts and what the difference is, and of course encouraging them to come to these meetings so we can talk some more about it. So with that, what I'd like to do is go through just some of these slides and give you an idea of some of the key points that we want to cover in the presentation. The page number one of these slides just gives you a kind of an outline of the topics that we're going to be covering. First one, how are employer rates set? We want to give employers at least a basic understanding of how the rate setting process proceeds, what an actuarial valuation does and how that's conducted, and why we fund the system the way that we do, and the benefits of that. We want to give them some history of how we got to where we are today, what happened after the 97 valuation, why most employers' rates, at least in the local government area, did go up, just to give them some background of how we got to where we are today. The third, fourth bullet there, what employers are affected positively and which are affected negatively. There is really two groups of employers now, if you want to look at it that way. The vast majority are in a situation where the adjustments we've made in our actuarial assumptions and some of the interest crediting methods have put most employers, we believe, on a stable rate setting going forward. Their rates should be relatively stable going into the future. And that's the vast majority. There's a minority of employers that do have a potential continuing problem, and we want to make that clear to them and make clear who those employers are and talk about what solutions might be available. We want to talk about what the PERS board has done and is doing on this issue, and talk to them also about what they should be considering doing at this time. And the final one is what will happen next in this process, and I'll mention that a little bit more. The first substantial slide that I've included here, why did most employers' rates increase? The key factor was the increase in the system's liabilities, mainly due to exceptional earnings in a two-year period, 21% in 1996, 18.7% in 1997. Those were the two highest earnings years in the history of the system since 1946, and they occurred back-to-back. And they're not the only reasons for the increase in the rates, but they are, they're the probably the most significant issue. Other things like House Bill 3349, some of the methods that we formerly used to credit interest, and those sorts of things were also factors. But this was a very significant factor. The next slide I put in there to give employers an idea of why on an individual basis their rates may have gone up more significantly than the rest of employers. Because of the things I mentioned, the high earnings and the spreading methods and House Bill 3349 all affected employers. But since all of our local government employers are individually rated, they each have an individual employer rate. In contrast to all of the schools who are in a pool, or all of the state agencies who are in another pool and pay the same rate, each local government employer pays a separate rate. And that is a situation where their rate can go up and down with each valuation significantly. Put this slide in to give just one illustration of why that can happen. And it has to do with the disability. In order to fund the system the way we do, which is we pre-fund the system, our actuary tries to anticipate the liabilities, in other words, what the cost of benefits will be. And we try and set rates so that we can pre-fund that and thus get the value of interest earnings over the life of a person's career in order to pay that benefit. For instance, today, interest earnings are paying about 84% of the cost of running the system and paying the system's benefits. If we were like Social Security, for instance, where they wait until the end of a person's career and then tax the population in order to pay the liabilities that have accrued, the cost of the system would be on the order of 10 times greater than it is today. So we do pre-fund, and there's some significant advantages in that. But in order to do that, we have to make assumptions about what the future liabilities are going to be. And I think the disability area is a good example. We do have a disability benefit. If someone becomes disabled, they're able to retire early, and we call it a disability retirement. In order to charge employers a proper amount to fund that benefit, our actuary provides an assumption to us, and right now it's less than one person in 1,000 we estimate will be disabled over the course of their career. However, if you're an employer, and this example is an employer with 5 employees, and one of your employees becomes disabled, that's 1 in 5. That's not 1 in 1,000. In the component of the employer rate that we have set aside to pay for disabilities is not going to have been enough to pay for that disabled employee. So your rate will go up as a result of that. And in this case, it's just a typical example, but if the rate was 6.2%, in this example, it would go to 14.15, more than double the rate just because of one disability or a small employer. The smaller employers, there's a really significant risk to them to be individually rated the way they are, and we want to provide some information about that to them. Some of the other key points going to slide number, so small, is that 3, 5?
David, too, in the interest of time, yeah. Could I have you just kind of skip through some of these and not go quite into...
Okay, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay.
The other key point is that the money match is now the key calculation. 95% of the folks are going to retire under that, and basically that means that the employer will match the employee's account at retirement. So on a going forward basis, we look at the employer's account, and if the employer has less in their account than the employees do, they're significantly underfunded, and I want to make that point clear. Let's see. Going to the about slide number 8, that looks like. We've got about 490 local government employers. Of that number, 73 do not have the matching or funds that match or exceed the amount of their employees. So that's the folks that have a potential ongoing problem. If we do earn 8%, which is our long-term assumption, their rates will have been set properly, and they will be relatively stable going forward assuming that all the other assumptions are relative and correct. If, however, we earn more than 8%, for these folks, more than likely their rate is going to increase. The opposite is true for the remainder. If we earn more than likely their rate has a good chance of decreasing. What we know is that during the last 2 years, we have exceeded 8% in our earnings. So I wanted to make it clear to them what the future may hold for them. I think that's probably the main thing. I guess just to summarize, I think there's basically 3 points. One, that we're a money match system now, and you need to be able to match your employees' dollars in order to have stable rates. Second thing would be that as an individually rated entity, you run a significant risk. It's almost as if you are self-insuring. It's very similar to that. For most people, you could probably not have car insurance and you'd be okay, but it's not a good idea because if you do have that accident, it's going to cost you a lot of money. And individually rating the employers the way we do puts them in a similar situation. And the final thing was to talk about the pooling rule that has been drafted. I'll give them some background on that. And that is, of course, a way to reduce the risk for local government employers. The other initiative is a bonding measure that we're working with the Treasury on. That will probably result in a legislative proposal with two goals. One, to make it easy for local governments to issue a bond. The second, which is a greater stumbling block, is to craft a bonding measure that would create a bond that would interest the market for these taxable bonds. And that's a more significant hurdle. Talking with the Treasury about ways that we might be able to cross that hurdle. I can go into more details on the pooling rule if you'd like.
I would like you to do that. Would you take, say, about 5 minutes here and sure. Go into detail on that?
Okay. If you look at slide number 12, the draft pooling rule, this was put together by an ad hoc committee working with PERS staff. And a few months were taken to put this together. Some key points about the draft. It's voluntary. The wording of it says that the employer can join or not join. It is possible that it would be mandatory. After we have hearings on the rule, we'll go back to the board, and it will be up to the board to determine whether we should make this a mandatory pooling issue or voluntary. But for today, it's voluntary.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Loken.
May we ask questions as we go along, or would you prefer that we wait?
Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to bring them back again. They're going to take leave here in a few moments, and I'm going to bring some folks up. They will be back to summarize. If you would like to wait until then.
That's fine.
Appreciate that. Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
A couple of details about the rule, the way it's crafted today. We would ask that employers, in order to opt out, they need to make a positive, they need to let us know that they want to opt out. If they don't communicate with us, then they would be members of the pool. Once in the pool, you would not be able to opt out of the pool at any time in the future. And the basic reason for that is that once we pool the assets, it's very difficult to separate those assets equitably. Another key point is this would establish a date certain, and all an employer's liabilities before this date would remain with that employer. In other words, if regardless of whether you're overfunded or underfunded, you would still have that liability to pay off, either to pay or to be amortized. And employers joining the pool because of that would not be responsible for the prior debts of other employers. In the future, employers could join at any time. And going to slide number 14. I'm sorry, I have an abbreviated version, and the numbers on the page are very small. I swear, a couple of years ago, I could have read those. Something's happening.
You're not the only one.
That's correct.
The liabilities that would be set aside before that date certain, that would remain with each employer, would be paid off to PERS over 30 years at a rate of 8%. All an employer's liabilities accrued after that date would then be pooled. Employers would pay separate rates for general service employees versus police and fire employees. There are different costs. Police and fire employees cost a little bit more, and some of the employers that do not have any police or fire employees were concerned that they didn't feel it was fair that they should have to pay some portion of the cost for police and fire employees. So there would be separate costs, and employers that didn't have any police or fire employees would not be paying any portion of the cost for police and fire employees. And that is the summary of the pooling rule. It's, as I said, it was developed by an ad hoc committee. That committee's on hiatus for a while we go out and conduct the employer outreach program. And we'll probably reconvene in September or so to make any other changes they feel are necessary for the rule before the rule goes back to the board. And then, following review by the board in October, we'll go out for hearings around the state in November, and in December the board will make a final decision on that rule. And that concludes my comments on pooling.
Mr. Chairman, could I add just one point on David's remarks? Mm-hmm. From our interactions with stakeholders, it's clear that among the many technical issues about how pooling can work and what are its pros and cons, there are two that often come to the forefront, or I should say there's one that comes to the forefront very quickly, and I fear that it will cover, mask, and limit debate on what I think is the most important question, and let me explain what I mean by that. The voluntary versus mandatory issue is a very excitable issue, and for understandable reasons, and it is an absolutely legitimate question to put on the table. My fear is that it is so understandable, and it involves the rights of municipalities versus the authority of the agency and the needs of the system and so on, that it deserves a debate in its own right. And, in fact, we are engaging in that debate. We've written the rule as voluntary. Our AG has told us that we probably do have the ability to make it mandatory, but we're not there yet. But the critical question and one of our major goals in the employer outreach is to tell employers and give them as much information as we can to help them understand what we know about making this decision. And there's an important decision here to be made by local employers about whether they want to self-insure or whether they want to join a pool. That's an enormous risk management decision that we see already in place because we have municipalities in difficulty. And it would be a shame if we went through this effort and spent and allowed the debate over the legitimate issue of voluntary versus mandatory to, in essence, crowd out our ability to treat what's the heart of the financial issue, which is self-insure versus insure in a pool.
Good. I think at this point in time I'll have you take leave for just a moment, and I will have Hasina Squires, representing special districts, take the podium here for just a few moments. Thank you. Thank you very much. Hasina, we wanted you to bring up an issue that I think you have, and that is about the nature of the pooling meetings, the outreach meetings relating to pooling.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Hasina Squires. I represent the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I guess I see the nature of the pooling rule as being characterized as voluntary is arguable. To me, voluntary means that if I want to choose something, I make an affirmative action to belong to something or to do something. This rule, as written currently, is voluntary in the sense that you can choose to get out of what it is they are doing to you. If I'm an employer, if the rule as proposed went through, and I'm an employer, and I don't indicate to PERS that I would not like to be part of the pool, I'm automatically in the pool. And my concern is that probably not for most of the large cities or for the large counties, but for some of the smaller special districts, that enough education is done about pooling and how it may potentially impact those smaller entities who may have one half of an FTE working 5 days a week, whether or not the education level can be achieved to understand that you must take an affirmative action to PERS to indicate that you do not want to be in the pool. So I don't think the pool really represents a voluntary type of attitude. And I think in discussing with some of the other employers that have participated in the ad hoc committee on pooling, the sense that we got where we were going with the draft rule was that it would be voluntary and you would choose to opt out of the pool if you would choose to opt out of the pool. Or opt into the pool, I'm sorry. You would choose to opt into the pool. If you wanted to be in the pool, you would just say, I'd like to be in the pool. So that was kind of a fundamental change, I think, from where the pooling task force was going. Another concern that I have with, I think it's great that PERS is going out to do some employer outreach, and I think that's a positive step in the right direction. But they're going to be discussing a draft pooling rule that really has a lot of gaps in it. There's a lot of unknowns. When will it start? Will it start in 97 versus 99, or will it start in 2001 or 98? And how much unfunded liability will be cut off and not included into that pool? I think it will be complicated for employers to understand the magnitude of the impacts of the proposed rule when there are so many unanswered questions about what the rule will finally end up being. My concern is that employers will sit in a meeting with PERS and an employer outreach and they say, this is voluntary, it has the potential to be mandatory, and not understanding the differences between what may or may not occur, what may or may not occur in the next 6 months before PERS implements the rule. Will then we be in the situation of going back out to employers and re-educating them and saying, when they came to you at this time, this is what the draft rule looked like. You had to opt out of the system and the liabilities would be severed as of 1999. Well, now the rule potentially could say, and the unfunded liabilities will be severed as of 1997, and so all of those liabilities will be accepted by the pool. I think there's just a lot of unknowns about pooling and the draft rule, and I just like to indicate to the committee that in discussing a draft rule with employers, there are a lot of unknowns that it would be much more helpful if we had finalized what that rule was going to look like before we went. Before education was done about what it will do to employer contribution rates.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? All right. Thanks very much. Representative Lehman.
Ms. Squires, you talked about the level of sophistication of the big cities, and your organization has a lot of smaller districts. What's the level of sophistication, do you think, among your members in terms of your understanding of the whole issue and how it's going to go sitting here today?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, it has been very difficult for me to communicate to even the members of the Special District's Legislative Committee about what's going on with PERS, because we've been having so many discussions and so much dialogue with PERS and so many ad hoc meetings that every time we have some sort of a discussion, the next meeting, everything changes. I mean, it's like the legislative process, you know, it's another hearing, and, well, now the proposal looks like this. So we've really tried to hold off on holding, you know, some sort of statewide association meeting with our employers that are in PERS and trying to explain to them what's going on, because things are changing. This is a continually developing process that we're going through, and so that's part of our struggle too.
Thank you. Other questions? All right. Thanks much. Appreciate that. Let's continue and call Nancy Brewer, City of Corvallis. And Nancy's going to articulate some local government concerns, some issues with her system. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I am Nancy Brewer, and I'm the finance director for the City of Corvallis. I'm also now the chair of the League of Oregon Cities PERS Task Force. And I sit here before you, I think, as a representative of both groups. The League is certainly concerned about what's happening with PERS because the fiscal impact on their members can be very substantial. And I can tell you that at recent Budget Commission meetings, the subject of what's happening with PERS to the City of Corvallis was also a pretty substantial item of discussion. The impact on our budget is approaching $3 million a year on a $50 million operating budget. So we're getting very close to about 6% of our annual operating budget going to PERS with not a lot of ability to control that. And that's happening, of course, at the same time as many other local governments when our property tax revenues are declining. We have been participating in a lot of the discussions that PERS has been having in ad hoc work groups, certainly through the League of Oregon Cities Committee meetings, talking about what's been happening with PERS. And one of the big issues that we've been looking for is this flow chart or white paper or whatever you want to call it about how money moves through the PERS system. And I think fundamentally we believe that it's critical to get that information locked down before we make any major steps in making any additional changes to the system. Now, I think what we like to think of is PERS is a system, and any changes that you make in one area of the system, by definition, will almost always affect some other aspect of the system. If you don't know how the system currently operates, you don't always have the opportunity to look at the change that you're proposing and how it flows all the way through the system and what the ultimate end result will be. We think that it's pretty important to make sure that there is consistent handling of money and that the monies are accounted for correctly, and that it doesn't make any difference whether it is an employee contribution or an employer contribution. Those monies get handled in the same way through the system. If there is a difference, it's a known, identifiable, purposeful difference in how those monies are managed. We also think that as we start talking about how we fund our unfunded liability and the potential for bonding, if the City of Corvallis takes that issue on, either alone, trying to find the money within our current budget to pay down our unfunded liability, or working in conjunction with a number of other entities to bond fund our unfunded liability, we have to be assured that this is a one-time solution and that we will not turn around in 4 or 5 or 6 years and get another 40 or 50% rate increase because we have yet again created another substantial unfunded liability. We also think that it's important to know how the money moves and to make sure that when the PERS actuary does his actuarial assessments, he's making the same assumptions about how the system works as the system makes about how the system works, and that there are not differences, and he thinks that it works the way, say, a normal retirement plan would work, but the Oregon PERS system has some differences in how monies are handled. We also believe that PERS cannot complete a reengineering of their system without knowing how the system currently works and why it works that way, whether or not some of the idiosyncrasies of the system are based on failures of hardware and software to do exactly what we want it to do when we want it to do that, or whether or not those idiosyncrasies are a result of legislation or rulemaking that we actually want to have in the system. Having recently gone through a replacement of the City of Corvallis financial system, I can tell you if you don't sit down and look at what you do today, if your system is flawed, you can put a perfectly good financial system in place but still have a flawed system. And sometimes you end up with some strange little idiosyncrasies that are there because somebody who worked here 25 years ago started doing something in a certain way, and we've never really thought about it. We've never really gone back and evaluated whether or not that was a good thing to do or not. We think that future changes in the PERS system need to be able to be mapped through this kind of a flow chart. To look at the movement, if you, in particular, as we started talking about pooling employees or employers' accounts, if we're going to pool employers' accounts, what will be the changes to this flow chart? How will the money come in and how will the money go out? If we talk about the inability to segregate the unfunded liabilities to an employer in the pool, what will that mean to the other employers who may be in that pool? There's a rule that's under discussion right now that PERS staff has proposed without doing a complete fiscal analysis about what happens when an employer does bond fund their unfunded liability, how that impacts a gain loss reserve that, based upon the draft rule, could make bonding not a particularly appealing solution because it may very well increase costs to the employer by 15 to 20%. That's not necessarily going to work well for small entities or large ones. We also believe that it would be critical to be able to use this model to be able to provide information to local government employers on a more routine basis about what the status is of their account balance, how close or how far that employer is from actuarial assumptions about the either the pool or the employer themselves. In other words, does the city of Corvallis have better longevity or worse longevity history than the actuarial is assuming or pools, so that I can start making some judgments about how that may impact rates for us in the future. We are interested in what's happening with the discussion on pooling, but I would have to tell you that sitting here today, I could not sit in front of my city council and say to them pooling would be good or pooling would be bad. I could not make a recommendation to them to say this is something we should pursue or something we should not pursue. There are a number of unanswered questions, not the least of which for me, besides getting past voluntary, mandatory, once you're in, you can't ever get out kinds of issues, are what happens to an entity like Corvallis that walks into the pool cash poor. We are one of the notorious 73. We have a lower employer balance than our employees have. And by definition, that means when it comes time to allocate interest, we will not have enough money. We will never be able to accrue as much interest as employee account balances. So even the ability to segregate our unfunded liability into some other pot and identify some particular part of our rate that's going to pay that off, as an entity, the pool cannot have as large a cash balance if we're in it as our employees will have. And that's for me, that's a critical issue, because what that starts sounding like to me is, at the end of year one, the pool will have accrued an unfunded liability, which will be worse at the end of year two and worse still at the end of year three. And so though we may start the pool with a base rate of 7%, by the time we get 4 or 5 years out, we may be looking at a pool rate of 14%, and we're still paying 7 or 8% over here to pay off our prior unfunded liability, which is no better than where we are today. And so I guess I would like to say that I appreciate the opportunity to come here, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. I do appreciate the opportunity that we have had working with PERS staff. I did sit in on the focus group and talked with them about their employer outreach meetings, and I think they're pretty clear on the questions that will be coming from the city of Corvallis when they meet with us. But I guess we are also pushing hard for the PERS system to be a good fiscally sound system long into the future. I know I count on it for my retirement, should I last that long. With any questions, I would answer anything you've got.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Boyko and Mr. Bailey, if you'd come back. Thank you. I'd like to open it up to questions for a few moments, and then after we address those specific questions, let you run in summation, if you would. Question that I would like to begin with. I understand the nervousness that a municipality would have about bonding. I can see them doing it to retire the debt, but the assurances about this happening again, obviously, for a finance director and any official of a municipality, that would be a great fear of seeing that happen. And of course, the legislature can be involved in something like that. But by and large, we tend to look at PERS policy as being the thing that would drive that. I would hope so. Let me ask you, what kind of assurances can we give cities, counties on issues like this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the first thing I'd say is that there are two distinct and separate questions, although both of them very important. The first one is, does bonding make sense, the substitution of interest payments for long-term obligations to PERS? That's a financial decision. As Nancy alluded to, it's an important one. Whether or not the PERS system will run into trouble in new areas again in the future, I can only assure you that nobody sitting at this table is interested in doing in seeing that and will knock ourselves out to make sure it doesn't happen. I will say that we believe we have a good handle on why the mismatch occurred as we switched over to the money match system and why municipal and other local government accounts got out of whack, out of balance with their employee accounts. We can trace the money and show precisely why, and I think they understand that too. I think the concern that they have, they've expressed to me that, yeah, we think you fixed that, but is there anything else? And I can tell you that we continue to search for, is there anything else? The valuation data that we will analyze when it comes from our actuary, Mr. Johnson, at the end of the summer, we will go through again to see if there's any pattern in the data that says something else is going on here other than the variable mismatch that the board, the agency identified and fixed. So I want to give you the assurance that I'll give you is that we won't leave any stones unturned to see if there are any other mismatches there. But it is a separate issue from whether or not it's wise to pool and bond with respect to past obligations.
Also, when it comes to the education level, as Hasina Squires was mentioning, relating to the small employers especially, another issue she mentioned that was of concern is what happens? Is there a gap between when the draft rule is considered, when it's adopted, enacted, and so forth? Are these small employers going to be caught with changing conditions in that period of time?
Well, let me say this, Mr. Chairman, that part of the rulemaking process is to put a draft out and start a discussion process going and then learning from it. For example, Nancy and some of her colleagues participated in the employee outreach dry run, if you will, and the presentation changed in response to the questions that they brought up and the issues and the recommendations they made. So in some respects, you have to start with something to get the discussion going. So yes, there will be changes in that respect. With regard to small employers, let me say this about the employee outreach and the burden that the agency carries as well as the local jurisdiction with respect to pooling and bonding. Nancy said, and I agree with her, that at this point she could not stand up in front of her city council and elected officials and say whether it was a good idea or a bad idea. And I will tell you, I couldn't tell them that either with respect to Corvallis. The joint burden that we carry, and I mean Nancy and her colleagues around the state and PERS, is to get to a point where this risk management decision can be made in an informed basis. This is step number one, to go out and lay out the what we know about pooling thus far and get input. And we're not asking for anybody to sign on a dotted line. Quite the opposite. And we expect to come back, hold additional ad hoc meetings. In fact, we have changed the rulemaking procedure at the agency to introduce an additional board meeting into the rulemaking cycle because some of our stakeholders, particularly employers, said, don't put us into a position where we have to argue on the fly with a rule that we disagree. And I think that's been very well received. You have some representatives here today. You can ask their own opinion. So we are trying. Do nothing is not an option. I think that's pretty clear. But in order to do what they advise physicians to do, which is do no harm, you have to do it in a deliberate fashion. And we have, in essence, added a cycle. And with this special issue of pooling and bonding, we've added a big cycle so that we can try to get to the point where Nancy and her colleagues feel confident about making a recommendation to their elected officials.
Can we be assured that the PERS board is going to become intimately familiar with the flowchart?
I can absolutely guarantee that. Now, whether or not they'll follow every path, I mean, as I said, I wouldn't make that assurance about me, but will they be exposed to this project as well as the key analyses of policy decisions? I think we recently sent down a presentation that we gave to the board at the last meeting to your office, and I think that will be indicative of the kind of very detailed analysis that we hope to do on a regular basis.
There's some concern, and Nancy mentioned it a moment ago, about the flowchart being completed before major decisions are made.
I will tell you that the flowchart is a tool that helps people learn or think about policy issues, but I will tell you honestly that in my opinion, it's kind of the tool that's in the bottom of your toolbox that you need at times when you get lost in the process. For any decision, as in the lump sum rule for gain loss that Nancy alluded to, or with respect to pooling and bonding, it's going to be the analysis of the pros and cons and our best estimates of what the impacts are that are going to be. That's going to be the socket wrench, if you will, that you can use. Or I guess I'm not a mechanic, but I know there's a handful of tools that you
–
crescent wrench, that's it. Thank you, sir. That you use all the time.
Okay. Questions? Representative Loken, I think you probably have.
Well, I have several, and I don't know which one to start with.
Yeah, pick one.
Okay. To me, it sounds like some of the entities and probably the smaller jurisdictions are bearing the brunt of poor decision-making by the actuary and possibly PERS management because of poor communication and just marching ahead with a high employer liability, and now suddenly we're caught. And I am wondering how fair this is. It seems to me totally unfair. If a jurisdiction is operating in an efficient way, why should they bear the faults of an inefficient system?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loken, I guess I would agree and disagree with your statement respectfully. If you look at small local jurisdictions versus large ones, the same rules, the same system is being applied to all of them. However, there is a critical difference, and that it lies at the heart of this issue of whether or not small municipalities and jurisdictions should be pooled or should want to be pooled. And that is that they're at greater risk because, as David pointed out in his presentation, it's as though there was a system that's just for them. Same rules as for Portland, same everything else, except their population of employees is very small. And so that we have a jurisdiction that has testified that they're in severe financial trouble. What has happened is that one-fifth, 20% of their workforce has become disabled and changed their own actuarial basis. It's not that different rules are being applied to them, but with just a handful of people, it is as if the city of Portland suddenly had 20% of its workforce become disabled and we would have to pay this benefit. So you are absolutely right that there is a special issue with regard to small jurisdictions, but it's not that there's separate rules coming down from PERS that disadvantage them. They are disadvantaged or at greater risk, I should say, because they are unpooled.
Follow up. Was there not inaccuracy, I guess, in actuarial information as to what the EOR impact would be? I mean, the employer. Excuse me.
I guess I'll have to defer a little bit. I don't really want to take advantage of my newness in the system. There are oftentimes when we communicate with municipalities or local jurisdictions in which we iterate until we get the right answer. So I would not sit here and say that we've never given inaccurate information of any sort to either an individual member or to a local jurisdiction. But I will tell you that based on the few months that I've been involved with the system, the problems that local employers are having it doesn't seem to relate to some specific piece of information that was given them that was wrong or incomplete. There were some policy factors involved in the distribution of earnings in the past, particularly the variable mismatch, that did severely impact some local employers, and there's no question about that. I defer a little bit to David here that if there's a specific instance of misinformation you're referring to, we'd be happy to address it. But I will tell you that if I go back to the agency, my concern is more fixing the policy issues that are affecting lots of municipalities. But if there is a particular one that's been disadvantaged or been given bad information, we will address it.
Still a follow-up. I think what I have heard in other discussions that there was not a total understanding between the actuary and PERS on what was happening in the system, and that this led to some of these problems that we're facing. And one of you mentioned complete communication within your system is necessary. Now, someone needs to be responsible for that and accountable that this, when this happens, you know, should you really, who's going to take the brunt? And the other thought I have, and I'm going to leave that in your hands to think about, but when a system bonds, are we then, as taxpayers, going to pick that up as an extra expense to taxpayers?
Well, I guess we could have Nancy address that as well, but let me address your last question first, Representative Logan, and that is that by bonding, yes, municipalities or local jurisdiction would take on interest payments, and those interest payments would be paid off with tax revenues. So the general answer to your question is yes. They would be offset by a lower rate to PERS because their unfunded liability would be in essence reduced or eliminated by the principle of the bond being applied to it. So with respect to your first question, I guess I have to plead ignorance as to whether or not there were miscommunications between during this period where the system in essence flipped from one set of rules to the other. And I've heard the comment before that, looking back to 1997 or 98, who found it? Why didn't they find out earlier that the switch over to the money match would have significant consequences? I think those are all absolutely legitimate questions, but I guess where I sit, they are important only so far as they tell me something about what we can do to solve the problem going forward. I do agree with you in that respect that they do have some lessons to teach, but my number one issue is how do we fix the problems we have today?
Thank you. I appreciate that, that's where we have to go. But I bring this up with a thought that let's avoid it in the future. And I also, I'm still concerned about this pooling issue and having the small jurisdictions suffer from that. I'm concerned about bonding and having taxpayers suffer from it. So I don't know. Maybe our PERS system is too rich.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple questions on the pooling issue. If the pooling issue or the big discrepancies in rate increases for the very small districts are driven by disability, is there any other options in terms of either separating out the disability benefit and just pooling the risk on in? The other one is there could any type of a vehicle be created that would be, trying to search for the right term, but it seemed to me that a disability of a relatively short duration wouldn't have a huge impact on a particular entity, although it might even on an entity with only 5 employees. But if there was basically some type of catastrophe insurance, I guess, that if where you're not pooling all of the risk, but you're only pooling the extraordinary risk.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, that's actually an excellent question. First of all, let me clarify. When David said disability, he was using one of a long set of factors that can differentiate one local jurisdiction from another. Mm-hmm. Disability happens to be an important and expensive one, and it's one that's easily understood, but there are others as well. Turnover in the workforce, early retirement, percentage of police and fire, and there's a long list. And also, we're talking about permanent disability, those that require us by law to give the person, retirement benefits. So with that said, turning to the second part of your question, yes, it is possible. Somebody like Nancy from Corvallis could, in essence, go to a private insurance company and say, I don't want to join the pool, but I am concerned about the risks not associated with employee turnover that might cost me, but with disability, and see if you can get an insurance company to write you a policy, lay off that particular risk. And from my point of view, from, you know, that's the city of Corvallis' analysis to do, and it may be workable. I think it'd be pretty hard, though. And if we are going to have an uphill battle to make sure that we raise this joint burden that I talked about, that the local jurisdictions and PERS both understand as well as possible what pooling and bonding means, it's going to be, if you think that's difficult, writing specific side policies on specific risks and finding an insurer to do it is going to be expensive and extremely complicated, but it's a fascinating idea.
Well, it would seem to me it would only work if there was like a common policy available. A small entity with 5 employees probably wouldn't be in a position to negotiate that type of coverage on their own. They would need either a lot of help from either one of the associations or from PERS in order to do it.
Well, I will tell you that we will mention that with our employer ad hoc advisory group, bring it up, because if they think it's a good idea, we will spend some time exploring it with them, and you know, we can, if they would like to pursue it, we can. I will tell you, from a professional point of view, I'm skeptical that it will work, but I've been proven wrong before. So we will raise that issue in those meetings.
Thank you.
Further questions? All right, thank you. I'd like to give you some time to summarize here.
I appreciate that. There is one final topic, and I'll indulge your patience for about 3 minutes to talk about it, because I really think it is important. I'd like to spend about 3 minutes talking about the initiative we have underway to codify the very extensive list of agency rules and practices at PERS into a comprehensive defined set of what we're calling colloquial our business rules. These are the rules, and they range from the tiny to the big. We're embarking on this effort for 2 reasons. Either one, by the way, is important enough to justify the resources that we're expending. First of all, we discovered early on that we need a clear and unambiguous written description of our rules of practice as the foundation for implementing our reengineering project. I mean, the programmers that we have, as well as the workflow analysts, have to begin with a complete set of our business rules, that is how we run our business, before they can write computer code that executes it for us and devise improved workflows. And we are very dependent on the success of this project. And so it was a no-brainer, if you will, that we had to put the effort into doing these business rules. The second reason I think that justifies this effort is we need in a single place a set of written administrative rules, and I must say preferably written in plain English, where members, employees, oversight bodies, other stakeholders can examine the operating procedures of the PERS system independent of having to get the view verbally from a staff member. They can start off with what's written, and then we can interpret. But it'll help us, and it'll help them. This has proven to be a very big task, bigger than I expected, because over the 54 years that PERS has been in place, the size, the scope, the complexity of the system has really grown enormously. I mean, just taking note of our 194,000 individual members, you know, 490 unpooled employers, 2 massive pools for teachers and state employees, respectively, that David talked about, separate treatments for subgroups like police and fire and disabled workers. We also, of course, have statewide programs for retiree health insurance and a very successful tax-deferred savings program that runs independently of the traditional PERS system. I mean, these just begin to indicate the complexity that we and our stakeholders must confront, and I think you see it when you hear our stakeholders testify before you that the system is very difficult to get your arms around, and we would echo that. To execute a slate of responsibilities this broad, fairly and efficiently, we need these rules to guide our practice, and they're there. In fact, this effort to root them out has identified roughly 800 business rules, and the final count will likely exceed over 1,000. You know, not surprising if you look at our aging computer system, well, no, to no surprise, we have about 1,000 subroutines in our system. And many of them have been tacked on to the system that was installed about 10 years ago over the succeeding 10 years as the program has changed and mutated and things have been added to it. But I think this project has great promise. I don't want to get people too excited about it because it's so big, it's going to take a long time. But I did want to bring it to your attention because I think it holds great promise for us, our stakeholders, and for the people who give us oversight. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Representative Winters.
Thank you. Just a comment, and I would commend you to on your project, and I would hope that instead of an increase from 800 to 1,000, that when you talk about clear and concise language, that when you look at it, that maybe there may be the opportunity to reduce the amount and not increase the number. But I do commend you because I think that often we just continue to add on and add on. And in some instance, I think when you begin to look, you will find overlap and duplication, and maybe that's an opportunity to streamline it.
Representative Winters, I couldn't agree with you more. Nothing makes us more pleased than to find duplications because we can draw a line through them and make the number go down. But pragmatically, I have to tell you that a complex program requires a complex and large set of rules in order for all of its stakeholders to feel some confidence in it. And it's one of those dilemmas we find ourselves in, but nothing would make me happier if we could have a smaller number.
Gentlemen, thank you, and best of luck.
Yeah. I'm going to need that.
All right. Committee, any final words from anyone here today? Representative Hanson.
Yeah, I'd rather make these the final words than questions. And first, just a comment on the flow chart, and I don't want to accuse anyone of plagiarism, but that looks very similar to a wiring diagram I saw on a 48 Chevrolet. just two comments. One is on the issue of the opting in or opting out, and I think I come down on the idea that the special districts or the people in the pools or should make an affirmative decision either to opt in or out, because I see this as such an important issue for them that there needs to be really good discussion at the local board level. I think Representative Witt at our last meeting expressed a view that the local government officials would have the wisdom to make that decision. But I certainly agree with that. But I think it's something that is so important, and there is such a potential for liability to their taxpayers, that it needs to be discussed at the local level. And I think that I wouldn't want that decision to be made just in a vacuum of not making a decision. The other one is I really agree with our friend from Corvallis in terms of the increased communication. And how important that's going to be for local government on a whole range of other decisions that aren't really PERS decisions. But I was thinking back when I had my Multnomah County Commission hat a couple of years ago when Measure 50 was implemented. We did a early retirement package in order to ease some of the problems that were going to be created with some layoffs. I don't think the issue of what that would do to our PERS costs was ever discussed as we were making that decision. There were some good reasons for us to make the decision. It lowered our employee costs by getting some people that were high-end employees to retire a little earlier, and we were able to replace them with lower-cost employees. We got a little different mix of skills that way, and I think there were good reasons for it. But we made that certainly in a vacuum without any type of discussion in terms of what its impact on PERS would be. So the more you can do in terms of clarifying, the more information that's available for local government. It's not just on this issue, but there may be a whole other range of personnel issues that they really need that good information from PERS and the potential on how other personnel questions are going to relate. The other one that I think is a warning to all of us is we took the complexity of the PERS system for granted for too long. It was something that they just wasn't talked about at Multnomah County much. It was only when the rate increases came forward that it really got on people's radar level. And we don't want to see that happen again. I mean, this is always a dynamic system. You wonder, when you look at these 20% increases, and now we've got maybe a little different market structure, what would happen if we had 3 years of decreases or 3 years of just limited to 8% growth, and how's that going to affect us? And I don't think that information is clear. But anyway, from the standpoint of, I think you're doing a great job in terms of the flow chart and increasing the information that's available. But then the local governments are going to have to discuss it and take advantage of that increased information.
Thank you. Any further? All right. No further discussion. We'll adjourn. Next meeting is Thursday, the 21st of September. Committee adjourned.
We hope.